So we have a special treat this evening, in addition to the tea and cookies. We have a guest speaker who is the new chaplain of Colorado College, Alex Hernandez Siegel.
It's a mouthful.
Did I get it all?
Got it all.
He arrived this summer, just in time for the start of a new academic year. And my impression is he's been running pretty steadily ever since. Very, very active guy at a very active college.
Yes.
Alex comes here from Harvard University, where he's been studying with probably the leading scholar on religion in America, Diana Eck. And so she's written a book just recently on pluralism in America, mm-hmm. bringing all of the different religions into view and reflecting on how they can interact with each other. So we're kind of excited. We think Alex may be bringing that perspective to Colorado College. But it's not as though the college has not already been welcoming of other faiths. Mm-hmm. We're here, this has been our home for practically the inception of this group, and over 20 years. It's been a very welcoming place for us. We've co-sponsored many events and speakers, as well as brought students and sometimes members of the college staff into our practice. But this is our chance to get acquainted with our new chaplain and launch a new period in our history. Mm. So thank you, Alex, for coming, and looking forward to hearing from you.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. I think back in my 3.5 months here have been some of the most wonderful of my career. And speaking of Diana Eck, she gave me a B+, my last course with her. So a bit of unfinished business there. I'll kind of hope to see her on Monday when I'm back at Harvard I'm back in Boston for the holiday. But you're correct. Diana Eck and her work at the Pluralism Project set a strong foundation of really what I was hoping to accomplish as a college chaplain. And you know, thinking, as when I first met with Liz, discussing about this new chapter, that I repeatedly used the phrase, it's about the anthropology of it and the togetherness of this. And something Diana Eck was a big fan of, which I believe she borrowed from Harvard Business School, was the case study method. So we read many cases rigorously and discussed in sections of how to approach different issues in religious pluralism. And her book especially talks about the fact that this is no longer just a Christian country, and that we need to respect the pluralism and the different elements of that. With my work with Diana, when I was thinking about my next chapter as a college chaplain, because I was the Mennonite chaplain at Harvard for 5 years, that if I was able to become a chaplain of a college, how do we take that case study method that she grilled us with, really to day-to-day practice of working with our students in our communities? And something I really want to emphasize with the students, because I think in the 21st century, the college chaplaincy and its work is very different than it used to be. That traditionally it's been one that has had very strong Christian traditions, one that has had required chapel over the years. Right now, the 21st century chaplaincy is really emphasizing how do we develop students in terms of their leadership skills and their life skills, working with the diversity of not just ethnicities, races, but also people and their beliefs in their communities. So the work that I have been trying to do in my first 3 months is really engaging students with those different themes. I think back, I think especially thinking about the self-exploration piece of Buddhism, especially Zen Buddhism, that you know, we always have to remember those moments that have led us even in a transcendental way. I remember when I received the call from the search firm that the college hired looking for the new chaplain. I had just landed in Las Vegas, not the most chaplain-type cities.
There are chapels, though.
Yes, there are. You want a quick marriage. That wasn't my ultimate destination, Las Vegas. My wife and I really believe in, you know, the beauty of nature and how do we communicate with it. So we're very big national park fiends. So landing in Vegas at 11 o'clock at night, we were driving to Death Valley National Park, which was 2 hours away. And there's something magical about driving in that area of the country late at night where you cannot see anything, but you know what's around you. Absolutely nothing. And just as a child, you know, reading these books about national parks that my teachers would give me and finally being able to see them, we're driving, and you see, oh, we're about 5,000 feet. And then it's 3,000, 1,000. And then you're below sea level, you know, 200 feet below sea level. And just seeing the signs in the darkness, you start thinking about your life and where you're going and how do you guide yourself to places when sometimes you don't have the clearest vision of how to do that. And we arrived at Furnace Creek, which is a little oasis in Death Valley National Park, the only place you could stay. But of course, there's no signal on your cell phone. But finally, I got the signal. I heard from Spellman and Johnson in an email, we want to speak with you. So these moments you always remember. And I remember the next day before I replied thinking, is this the right journey for me? Sitting outside with, you know, the palm trees that are there and this, you know, just this desolate place, but it's a desolation in such beauty. Where they filmed Star Wars too, by the way, so it did have an, you know, otherworldly sense to it. But this was an opportunity really to combine so many things that were important to me in terms of education for students, my Mennonite background, and to provide leadership in what I again say, what is the anthropology of the work that we do? And how do we strengthen our communities and emphasize what do we have in common versus what our differences are? Which I think throughout human history, that's been the cause of the greatest conflicts that we've seen. And this is something I also want students to understand, that how do we connect all the work we do in terms of our faith and spiritual practice with other things that they do in their lives? So I think we've often been taught that each thing is very separate from one another, and they're not. How do we connect our spirituality with the work that the Wellness Center is doing in terms of students taking care of each other and themselves? You know, the Butler Center here as well, which is a multicultural student center. You know, how do we look at the diversity of religions, you know, the immigration that's tied to it, and the changing landscape that Diana Eck talks about? That these are things I really want to connect into, you know, a molecule of really learning and growth and helping students explore the connections to all of this. Especially with the group here tonight and the practice that you do, I think about my own Mennonite background and our journey to that. Because I think so much of the work that we do has to do with our finding our spirits and nurturing those spirits through the community of people that we share it with. I think we may have disagreements on doctrine, we may have disagreements on how we interpret text, but we have disagreements on how do we interact with each other, which I think is the most important thing in terms of the creation of human or religious organizations. I grew up in a Puerto Rican Pentecostal church, which are very loud. A lot of drumming, a lot of speaking in tongues. And as a child, like, what is this? And not really understanding it. And then being told to shush when I would ask questions. This is a holy moment. But then New York City at the time, in the early 80s, was not the best place to live. And my mother decided, like, mijo, she says, it's time we're going. She's from Puerto Rico. She says, it's time for us to go. I said, Mom, you know, where are we going? Well, we knew New York City. And she says, well, first choice is Montreal. Foreign country, I need to learn French. I love that. You know, I'm 15 years old at the time. The next choice was Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm like, even better. And the third choice was Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I stopped, and even at 15, like, how does that fit into the triangle of cool? You know, Montreal, Santa Fe here. But as my mother explained it to me, and I saw later on, she had friends who were doing voluntary service in New York City and Queens, who were Mennonites from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And over the years, my mother always noticed in terms of our congregations that we would see people on Sunday. They were very kind, very polite, but that's the only time we would see them on Sunday. I mean, granted, yes, New York is a big place, but those people live local near us. But we never saw them outside of that. The Mennonites you see almost every day. And in terms of their spiritual walk, they walk that walk in terms of emphasizing the importance of community and nurturing that community. And that deeply impressed my mother. And I think especially the horrors that she has seen in her life, what we saw in New York, she was looking for her new Zion, a new sanctuary. And Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and the rolling hills were going to be her Zion. And at 15, you obey your mother, especially if she's a Puerto Rican mother. And I remember the first year was an adjustment for me. You don't move a half Puerto Rican, half Jewish kid to a very conservative area of the country in the early 80s. But it grew on me. And I started to see among my peer group that there was such a caring and a community and a strong sense of exploration of that community and how we can continue to grow with each other, bring in people who are very different than the Swiss German Mennonite kids who grew up there for generations, that I felt at home, even though it was a strange home at first. But that brings me to my point about community, that even though we were so different than what they were accustomed to, we were accepted. They learned from us. And the thing I appreciate about my Mennonite heritage is that we don't go around preaching from Galatians or Deuteronomy when we're doing voluntary service around the globe. We preach through our actions and how we treat each other. In fact, there are going to be soon more Mennonites in the developing world than in North America, Canada, and the United States. Places like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia. And in our work, we always need to find common tribes with other people, things that we have in common with them. And when I would meet Ethiopians in Boston, the first thing I would say is, are you familiar with Meseret de Christos, the Mennonite church in Ethiopia? Like, oh yes! And they would get so excited. But there's something about the work I want to really emphasize here. It's the work through our actions, not necessarily about what we say. And especially the stance of the Mennonites with pacifism, with something I have a great deal of respect for and have embraced. It's just not in terms of the policy of our government with wars and conflict. We believe that there's always a diplomatic solution, but understanding that war brings more destruction to the innocent and to the minds of people who are serving their country in a way that could be destructive to their own souls and their own minds. But also being respectful of those who have decided to serve our country this way, and that our leaders send them with just cause and not for business interests, and especially if they're not sending their own children. So this is something we struggle with, especially during the Vietnam War, where many of us were jailed for being conscientious objectors, and some others went to work in Vietnam in medical centers for the wounded. But in my own stance of pacifism, I want to emphasize that I'm very supportive of the military and our men and women who are there, but to come home safely, and that they're not sent for reasons that could be avoided as much as possible. And that's something I try to think about our connections with Buddhism, about pacifism, care for community, and self-exploration. And during my time here, as I grow in this position, in my almost 4 months, you really feel at peace, and I feel at this point I found my own Zion. And in fact, the car trip out here by myself from Boston is called Operation Zion, because this is going to be my new sanctuary. And let me tell you, I've driven to California from New England before, but always with someone, or Texas with someone, never by myself. That's not me. I'm a New York City kid who likes the subway. But to get in a car and just go that distance on my own, I felt a peace about it, because this was meant to be. And I felt the people I'd be working with were going to be not only kindred spirits, but supportive of the journey I want for this chaplaincy. And I know everything has a front, also has a back, but so far I've not seen that back. It's been one of the best experiences I've had here. So I want my students to engage with all the community events we have here, with your group and other groups, because, as I said in the statement to the search committee, when I read that roughly 66% of the students here identify as maybe agnostic or atheist, I said a part of the liberal arts tradition is about seeking and exploring and learning from each other. My process right now of setting up a Muslim prayer room in the newly renovated Tutt Library is, yes, for convenience for the Muslim students so they could study, pray, go back to study in the library, because that's where they like to hang out. But also this is about seeking for other students to see what the lives of Muslims are like. What are their practices? How can they be respectful of them? This is why I'm at a smaller school where the liberal arts are at the center of what we do. Because this is, learning is about daily practice and interacting with each other. And to learn from each other without asking questions, but by seeing it and having conversations. And a large part of the job is management, like make sure the doors are locked so they're safe. Sorry about that. But this is because I want this to be a safe, you know, quiet zone for reflection, spirituality, and for the place to be respected. We need to have those foundations first. So this is a balance, being the chaplain of the college and associate dean of students. I was not certain how those two would fit, because they're often opposites. But the brilliance of it is that it really helps you engage in the larger picture of student life, see how they, as I said, connect to what we work in spirituality and inter-community life, but also how does it fit into their whole being? And if they are agnostic, how can they learn from each other and take parts of what we do here to form it as something that's meaningful for them as much as possible? So we have a mission ahead of us. And again, I trust my gut, because when we pray, I think sometimes people want direct answers from the Lord. I think the feeling in your gut is the answer. And I've learned that over the years. And even my own journey as a Mennonite, you need to find your place. Because at first in Pennsylvania, it was not my place. This very liberal kid found a place to be very conservative. And sometimes it didn't make sense to me. They preach pacifism and helping marginalized populations, but voting for Republicans. But when I went to New England, I felt I found my home. That the community and also the Mennonites here, which remind me of them, you find your own niche and you find your own place. And this is the part of the education I want for our students, that as they continue to grow and change, I want them to find those niches. And even if you run into something that is not your niche, give it more time and give it the opportunity to mold it and shape it into something that you can call your own and also be a part of a community that shares those values. And that can mean anything. So I welcome you in this journey. I'm so glad you're here, and you know, let me know how we could continue to make this a home for you and expand that as much as possible. Because as I said, I'm looking for the things that we have in common. And I feel with the Buddhists in terms of self-reflection, exploration, pacifism, and the deep understanding of what drives us in our communities is something we all share. Even if we, you know, look at it from different perspectives, but there are many paths to the truth. And this is where we begin here. So cheers.
So now we have an opportunity for people to question you.
Sure.
A question.
A
couple of questions.
Sure.
Well, first of all, welcome to Colorado Springs. Is it too late for that?
No.
Okay.
I just found the Trader Joe's the other day, so.
Trader Joe's.
Hey, exactly. I take them.
I was wondering a couple of things. How would you, because I know very little about the Mennonites, although I've seen them for a long time. I used to go back to Missouri and see those communities back there. Uh-huh. But how would you characterize their relationship to nature?
To?
Nature?
It would go hand in hand in terms of their work with, say, pacifism and communities. We have a book, cookbook, we're good at publishing too, called More with Less and Extending the Table. And this cookbook comes from a variety of recipes from around the world that people have done their volunteer service from everywhere from Kansas to Indonesia. And this book really emphasizes how do we make use of the limited resources of the earth, but also use it in abundance in a very qualitative way to share with others. I mean, they're not strict vegetarians, for example, things like, but it's really their emphasis is how do we protect the earth by ourselves, but also serving the basic necessary needs of our communities. So the earth, I think they really would have a really strong perspective. We have a perspective of, you know, peace isn't just about our relationships with each other, but how do we protect, you know, the earth that we inhabit, not only for our use, but for future generations, and caring for the ecosystems that support us as a people. Mm-hmm. So, but I always think of that cookbook because it's very basic things, making use of farming techniques in our smaller communities, but using in abundance of how do we share with others. Connections are more about how do we protect the earth at the same time. Mm-hmm.
So. Another one, just sort of a little more per se. You know, I used to go down to Chihuahua a lot in Mexico, and they're large, and I always used to visit the communities there. And they were fascinating.
And they made a lot of cheese.
Oh, the cheese was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was so good.
I mean, Mexicans go, oh, queso.
Queso,
yeah.
But I was wondering, the people down there, I mean, they spoke Spanish, obviously, but they also spoke a dialect of German.
Right, the High German.
High German, Hochdeutsch.
Right. So they still speak it in Pennsylvania.
Okay, that was my question.
Right, they do. Some of the River Brethren is another Anabaptist group that also speaks it. But especially with the Amish. The Amish, they're really our religious cousins, because a little bit history of the Anabaptist movement with the Reformation, at first they were just called the Anabaptists, meaning rebaptizers. So we baptize, it's another strong principle we have of baptizing individuals upon confession of faith, generally when you're a teenager or maybe a little bit older. When I was a baby born in a Catholic hospital in New York City, I was only 2.5 pounds in 1969. And generally, we didn't make it back then. So, of course, the nuns there panicked and swept me away to be baptized quickly. So I was originally baptized Catholic, but by accident. But when we joined the Mennonites in the early 80s, when I was 16, I was rebaptized, hence Anabaptist, by the Mennonites in Lancaster Conference. So the origins of the Mennonites come from areas, especially Germany, Switzerland, so they call it the Pennsylvania Dutch, which really means Pennsylvania Deutsch. But over the years, you know, the Americans have started calling it Dutch, so it's stuck. But it's really Deutsch. But it's a High German, probably closer to what you find in parts of Switzerland. Also parts of France that came from large numbers of German Mennonites also went to Russia. They were welcomed there. And they also connected with Muslim communities in the former Soviet Union as well.
Did you have to learn it?
A Pennsylvania German?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
No. Sometimes we would go to the Puerto Rican Mennonite church, which is also loud, too. But since I'm bilingual there, no. But I never. But I see sometimes the effects on English when they speak it, that instead of saying turn off the light, say out in the light.
Okay.
Right.
Or the pie is all, and I'm sitting there like, oh what? All good, all bad, all blueberry, but it's all gone. And words such as they'll say. We'll say, why don't you come over to my house for, I think it was supper. And I would throw up at, you know, night, and it was like, no, it was really lunchtime that they met. So little words like that would translate to English that like, doesn't really fit. So things like that. But no, I don't say, I speak a little bit of German, that, you know, they speak in places like Bonn, but it's a different dialect. I could pick up a little bits and pieces of it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Seems like an evening to take advantage of something I've only heard about, you know, Mennonite community in this country. And one of the things I heard was that Mennonite community welcomes new arrivals by everybody getting together and building their house. Is that true of the Mennonite, or was it true in the past?
Yes and no. What's popular in Lancaster are barn raisings, especially for a newlywed couple. They're setting up shop and the barn needs replacing. The whole community would come together and help, you know, build that barn. That was truer in the past, When we moved there, we had a house ready for us already, so that was taken care of. But what they did instead, for weeks on end, they would bring us food. You know, they would bring us food. You know, produce from their farms. You know, from the farmer's market, they would bring us things they made. You know, they were carpenters. If we needed electrical work done, they would come over and do it for free. And I love that German work ethic. You know, it gets done fast, efficiently. But I remember that as when I was 15, it was like 2 or 3 weeks, they would come over, bring us food almost every day. Because my mother wasn't working yet. She wanted to get out of New York fast. So I never forgot that. But the barn raisings are still common. Sometimes they will build houses, but the barn raising is more traditional. But in most cases, when people move into new homes, they're often already built. And in Lancaster, the development is crazy. So, and it's really a shame because it's some of the best land east of the Mississippi that it's going to the highest bidder, and those go to housing developments and corporations. Mm-hmm. So you'll see a lot of the Amish who can't compete with that, the millions of dollars that land is worth, they'll come west. So they'll be in Montana. There's a community not far from here. I see them at King Supers. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for new land in cheaper areas of the country. Holmes County, Ohio has the largest number of Amish. Mm-hmm. They're famous for that. Lancaster is second.
Seems to me that we went to an incredible farmer's market in Lancaster.
Was it Green Dragon?
Under a roof. It was just this.
Well, there's several. There's Green Dragon. Okay. There's Roots Market. We used to go every Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
And even this is like how much Lancaster has changed. There's one of my students now who just came from Lancaster. She's a student here. She says, did you move there before it got cool? Uh-huh. I said, I think I know what you mean, because when I arrived, the big indoor shopping mall in the basement was a dirt floor where there was a farmer's market. Uh-huh. Where usually you find a food court today, which there is a food court there today. Uh-huh. But upstairs there was Macy's and there was Bloom, all these things. Downstairs there was a farm market with a dirt floor. So I guess that was not the cool period.
Sounds cool.
So, going to the student, I'm like, yeah, I remember that. But that has always impressed me. And my mother, was a little bit stubborn. My name should be Siegel Hernandez, and usually the father's name comes first in Latin America. But she's the nonconformist, so she wanted Hernandez first. So Hernandez Siegel. But the part of her stubbornness is that she will not budge from Lancaster County. And one of my reasons for moving here is that she'll have a fighting chance of moving here with the cost of living. Because Boston, forget it. It's in the top five most expensive real estate markets. But she just turned 80. I'm hinting, oh, Mom, Colorado Springs. And she won't hear of it. Mm-mm. But I feel okay about it because she's in a community that's like family. That I call her gang of Mennonite friends. Who will probably give up their pacifism if they have to come after me for moving my mother. Because they're very attached to her, because she's been there for so many years. Mm-hmm. So I do not worry for one bit. Her brother's there too. But the fact is, I feel a great deal of comfort for being in that community. And it took me such a long time to accept the fact that we were there, because when you're from New York, nothing exists beyond the Hudson River. But she eventually knew when I finally accepted it. We were driving through New Jersey, going back to New York to see my grandmother because she still lived in Brooklyn. And I'm looking at the Jersey, the cornfields. I'm like, Mom, our corn is taller. It's better. And she is at that moment, I accepted that we were going to stay in Lancaster. So she started laughing. She says, oh, that was the moment. Our corn is better. So it's been a journey. So, yes.
So here at CC, I just wondered, with this generation of folks, I'm not even sure you can call them unchurched anymore, but, you know, how do you welcome them? And maybe invite them to try different things.
Let's say, for example, we have a student who is agnostic, maybe atheist, for example. And looking at my Mennonite way of doing things, I look to see what I have in common with that student. What do they enjoy doing? Even if we both love the New England Patriots, I will focus on that. Because to me, my preaching and the work that I do is trying to find something that empowers that student and try to find a connection what we do here. And many of the things that we often do have really varied connections. We just showed Phantom of the Opera, the original one here, with an organ concert, because Lon Chaney was from Colorado Springs.
Yeah.
A number of students I'd never met came in to see that. But to emphasize, this space is for everyone. You know, it doesn't matter what your beliefs are. But also being the associate dean, you get to connect with them and try to emphasize what's important to them. To me, that's spiritual. I don't think we're here to say, well, the more numbers that I have, the better work we'll do. I think it's really more to help students feel comfortable in a space that could be what they define for themselves. And as I told the search committee, I need to be for what that student needs for me to be at that moment, even if we don't agree on everything. But my outreach, in terms of addressing your question, is helping them find something they find interesting here and just explore it. And even if they don't decide to pursue it, they were given a way to find a home here based on, you know, their way of looking at things and their own grounding. Because I have a strict no proselytizing policy here. There are some groups that do that. And I speak to them when I say, I know your faith is important to you, I know the text is important to you, but preach to these students through your actions. One of them is married with two children. I said, you could speak to the students by, see how you treat your wife, how you treat your children, how do you raise them? You know, raising a healthy family of a strong partnership will speak volumes more than anything. So you connect things that way. But it's really helping lead the horse to water, but that water could have many different flavors.
So I have a related question, actually.
Yeah.
I remember a number of times over the years hearing students say that, and perhaps it's because such a high percentage of students identify themselves as agnostic or atheist,
mm-hmm.
but that it was not cool to be participating in a religious tradition, mm-hmm. and that they felt that there was prejudice against them if they had an sort of identified religious life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you've been hearing that from students or not, but I'm wondering sort of how you approach that.
I have not heard it directly, but I feel it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the best way to approach it is, you know, spirituality is something that's very personal, something to develop on our own. It doesn't necessarily have to be a part of a religious organization or a tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are many folks who have elements of Buddhism in them or Islam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in throughout our lives we try to find that grounding. And I emphasize to students, it may be one of these traditions, but also all traditions may have different boundaries to them. I want them to find their own way of finding their own spiritual self, even if it is, you know, I think of the Psalm 121, a song of ascents. You know, I lift my eyes to the mountains, where does my help come from?
Mm-hmm.
Just looking at Pike's Peak could be a spiritual moment for someone. Where do you find, you know, your being, your guidance, your intellectual, you know, exploration by finding beauty in things that you find wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was speaking with a student last week who is starting to question her faith. You know, she's not reading the Bible like she used to, and she's a student of color, and you know the obstacles our students of color go through at all the colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, how do I find my spirituality, she would ask, and I said, you know, this is a definition I want you to explore for yourself, but I think one of the best ways is to find people who uplift your spirit, who uplift you. And I find that myself, the people I interact with, who makes me smile,
mm-hmm.
who believes what I believe, and also who will help guide me in a direct way, defining the person I will become. I mean, you often find spirituality, you find God in the people that you're with. And I believe in angels, I believe in demons. We see demons every day. We also find angels. And I'm not talking about these miraculous moments that we see from time to time. I'm also discussing, you know, the day-to-day actions with people who just make you smile and uplift your spirit, because there are angels in them as well. So, but to be open to that, and you know, I see the obstacles and the barriers we put up for you know, members of the LGBT community, women, you know, students of color. You know, to me, that's something, I don't want that enemy to win. You know, and sometimes systems that we set up on this earth can be very demon in their appearance and their effects. And to find those people who will help you overcome those barriers as much as possible, even mentally and emotionally, and to build your emotional intelligence and your spiritual intelligence by, you know, looking for people who build that with you. So, but that's a process. And I think students want things tomorrow. But no, as I've learned, you don't know the beautiful things waiting for you around the corner. And I'm not the same person I was when I moved to Lancaster. The shy, skinny kid, me speak in front of a bunch of people like this? I don't think so. But who have I met along that journey who have been my role models, who have lifted my spirit to make me want to carry that heritage of what they've taught me and taught me? Because leaders, to me, should be people who exhibit a gentle strength, which is inclusive and loving. People who rule by fear are bosses, not leaders, and especially in their spiritual traditions.
Alex, it seems to me that something we can offer as a community to the college, the students especially, is the practice of meditation. I came out of a Protestant tradition, which didn't include meditation. If it was even acknowledged, it was acknowledged with some sense of suspicion. So, without proselytizing, to be able to offer a place where you can find this practice, find others who are doing it, maybe get some instruction, but mainly support in a practice that can be difficult. Well, so, I think, among other things that we might offer, this to me is what we uniquely can provide for the college.
In my conversation with the Dean of Students, who I report to, that this fall is really my time of assessment of things that have been successful, which I feel are going to be the most fulfilling and nurturing to the students. And meditation is definitely one of them. And that's one of the biggest priorities I have here. We have one session on Monday mornings, we have Thursdays, we have other ones as well. But the way I advertise is not really what I'm looking for, but we emphasize a mindfulness of the practice and the whole mind, body, and spirit. Because even the students who are not part of a religious tradition, you know, I emphasize, you know, the secular, you know, growth and community bonding. And so, you know, settlement of, you know, really inner peace that meditation brings to you. So it is a priority and it's growing. Probably not see too many students this week, but often, especially in the beginning of the blocks, on Mondays we were full. And we're bringing staff in as well to come in and join because I have an intern who runs it. So we're expanding. That's why we just got the benches over there because we're getting more people. So, yeah, anything that really connects to the whole mind, body, and spirit emphasis of student life is going to be included in the plan. I'm sounding like the dean now, but you know, the meditation I want to continue, and students, I want them also to feel free to join this group. It's a process of their own exploration. They may come once or twice, many times, or may not again, but they were given the opportunity to be part of a group and see how this all is a part of what I call the healing arts. Shouldn't be just said in medical school. I think there are many ways to heal people psychologically, emotionally, and community-wise. So to me, meditation is part of the healing arts, which should be a permanent part of what we do here.
Well, we are reaching a point of needing to wrap things up. So if there's, you know, one more question.
I think Zach
has something. Oh, just a quick comment. There's a wonderful nonprofit in town called Raw Tools. Have you heard of them?
No.
They're faith-based, and they're Mennonites who run the organization.
Oh.
And yeah, really, really great people. And what they do is, I think it's based on Isaiah, is it? Swords into plowshares. They turn various guns into garden tools.
Mm-hmm.
And they also do a lot of anti-gun violence advocacy work. And they, it's a father, Fred, and his son, Mike Martin, who are both Mennonites, who have a forge. And they go around across the country and convert guns into gardening tools. And they also do various workshops on it. And just something I figured I'd mention, just because
the
peace value is very strong here as well. So.
They may be members of Bethel Mennonite Church in the state.
They are. They are.
So I go to a Mountain Community Mennonite up in Palmer Lake.
Okay.
You know, they're the rebels too. So I don't know too many people from Bethel, so that's why I probably didn't hear of it.
Gotcha.
But when I joined that congregation, they were like so happy because, you know, they've been there for 30 years and newcomers don't come often.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was a small community and they were just very welcome. Hey, they sent me bread the first day. So, but no, thank you for telling me that.
Yes.
And, again, as I get to know the community here more, I'm seeing more connections with Bethel here downtown.
Uh-huh.
And Mountain Community has connections like a monument up through Denver. And a little bit here as well, but no, thank you. I'm not to look into that.
Yeah, Raw Tools is the nonprofit name.
So, Seth, tell Alex what you do.
Work for an organization called Colorado Springs Food Rescue that does a lot of food justice, food access, food education, and some food production work.
Yeah.
It actually came out of this college as well.
Excellent.
It was started by some students here, so yeah.
Well, there's a course here in anthropology with food and anthropology.
Huh.
Mario runs, he's a...
Yeah,
he does. That was one of the emphasis I had in college when I studied anthropology. It was gender relations, Latin America, but also coursework in anthropology and food. And I made the mistake of leaving one of my books on the U.S. food industry at home. My mother read it, and she became macrobiotic after that.
Yeah.
So my grandmother would call it La Casa de Hambre, the House of Hunger, because there was nothing good at home. There was shiitake, you know, there was seaweed, spinach, you know, lentils. And my grandmother would slip me a 20 and say in Spanish, go get the vanilla ice cream. Yeah. But my mother to this day, and my nickname for her is Linda Hamilton from the Terminator movies. Because she's 80, she's still lifting weights and eating macrobiotic food. So she has these muscles and everything. So not a force to be, even a past, you know, very peaceful Mennonite, not a force to be messed with. But yes, but the food industry, I mean, turbans especially, I work with pacifism. This is a part of our essence. And I have a sermon I wrote in search of non-enemies in the Song of Ruth that I think we're often redirected to who our enemies should be. You know, terrorist organizations, you know, North Korea. But there are many enemies here at home. And one of them is the food industry. And now the processing of food, you know, the genetic engineering, what they do to animals, you know, the medical insurance industry. In fact, if I take this shirt to get dry cleaned and I send my friend, who's a woman, to get it cleaned again, they'll charge her more money because she's a woman. The search of enemies are here. So, and that's actually the title of a book from John Stockwell with the CIA involvement in Angola. Mm-hmm. That the search for enemies after the defeat in Vietnam, where we're going to go next to find enemies. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.